You are tuned in to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. Tonight, my guest is David Sarita. David and several others had a life-changing experience in the late 60s upon witnessing a UFO hover for over 20 minutes and then visibly blink out. He directed and moderates the outstanding film titled Dan Aykroyd Unplugged, The Case for UFOs. He's made many other notable films on this subject, including The Case for NASA UFOs. An avid researcher, scientist, artist, photographer, and director, he is opening the door to our perceptions about the existence of UFOs, free energy, alternative energy, and future thinking paradigms on consciousness. You can find David's blog at www.davidsarita.blogspot.com, and he's on www.lightstreamtechnologies.com, and of course, on Facebook. So let's welcome him to the show now. Excuse me. Hi, David. How are you?
Hi, Lance. Glad you're hanging in there with your teeth.
Yes. Well, we won't mention those nasty
teeth. No, okay.
They're gone now. What's really funny, I have to tell you this. I was just lighting some candles and the fire in the fireplace so I could have a real fireside chat. And I was lighting a candle on the ledge, and there was the impression of my teeth that they had taken it, staring back at me, and it startled the heck out of me. So I was kind of scared for a moment, but I'm all right now. I'm getting over it.
That's good.
Well, you know, I saw your Dan Aykroyd Unplugged a long time ago, and it was an amazing film. I just loved it. And, you know, I would never have guessed. Of course, I like Dan Aykroyd as an actor, a comedian. I never knew he had such a brilliant mind and that he's so knowledgeable on the subject of UFOs as well. And you were a great interviewer. It's a terrific film.
Yeah, he's more, to me, he's the most brilliant person in Hollywood on the subject. And he needs to spend a lot more time with Steven Spielberg, whom he knows well. And, you know, it's really frustrating in Hollywood. You know, what sells today is mostly violence in UFOs, and it's really like the Battle of 42, for example. The real truth is much further away from the violence.
Uh-huh.
In fact, when the Battle of 42 happened, and everyone was told to stay indoors because we had, extraterrestrial intruders. Initially, it was thought that it was the Japanese, and then we started firing, you know, mortar shell rounds at it and all kinds of different munitions, 1,800 rounds. And they never fired back at us once. Not once did they attack Los Angeles. So it's really hilarious to me, this new film, The Battle of L.A., that the aliens were coming here to attack us. And it's just, unfortunately, you know, in the early days, what Spielberg was doing with Close Encounters and E.T. was probably closer to a lot of the truth. Not that they're all angels out there.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of different personalities in extraterrestrials, but with that particular case and what I know about Roswell is they never actually tried to attack us. It was us, our fear of them, that was really ballistic.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. In fact, I had Dr. Greer on not too long ago, and of course, he's well known for his belief that, you know, that the ETs that they're trying to contact are positive. And, you know, that eventually we will get to have that experience when we're able to raise our consciousness to the point where we're not killing each other and, you know, creating weapons of mass destruction that don't exist.
Yeah, I think that's what makes it hard for contact. I mean, I've done a number of very advanced high-technology transmissions to the Palladian group of ETs, whom, when I first saw that UFO in Berkeley in 1968, when I was 7 years old, you know, in the following nights, they appeared to me at nighttime behind sleep, and they were Palladian.
Wow.
And I didn't even know what that star system was. I was just shown it, and when I used to play hide-and-go-seek and count to 100 where my friends were hiding in San Francisco, I was looking at the Pleiades, and I didn't even know the name of it.
Wow. So
they showed me how their ships worked. They were totally human-looking, but much more energetic than we are vibrationally, and obviously technologically a lot more advanced. And since then, you know, my fascination with that star system has grown, and my ability to build technology has grown, and I have actually made contact with them several times, even actually a couple of nights ago. I put on Facebook that we sent out a transmission repeatedly asking them for, you know, please, please help the Japanese, and, you know, we sold the Japanese this nuclear technology, and they don't, you know... they don't know how to deal with this on their own. And we know from even, in fact, CNN this year, finally the story broke on Larry King, that all these Air Force officers came forward and testified that they had witnessed missile silo, they had witnessed UFOs actually taking over controls of the missiles and turning them on and turning them off and appearing above the plant. And there have been many incidences of UFOs visiting nuclear power plants in general. And if you really study the cases, there are a number of nuclear power plants in America amongst the 110 nuclear reactors we used to have that are so unstable that there's probably radiation detected by these saucers, and they're very concerned. So,
yeah,
you know, that being, you know, evident that they have that ability, I sent out this transmission.
Huh.
And every time we've done this, here at where I do the transmissions with this, it's unlike any other radio transmitter you can imagine. There's no way we can give away the secret. We actually tuned it to the vibration of the Pleiades star system.
Wow.
It's a harmonic. It's not a frequency.
Right, right.
And every time we've done it, we've got an answer. And in the middle of the wee hours of the morning after the transmission and the storm I created on Facebook, you know, with hundreds of responses and mostly people being very excited, I heard a robotic voice saying, they did not comply with natural law, and meaning not just the Japanese, but all of us, that we didn't comply with the oceans and the way we're treating the environment, and certainly putting nuclear power plants right on the coast.
Oh my God! Yeah.
And I thought, is that the karmic reason this happened? Because there's a lot of other people in the world that have done equally or more damage to the environment than they have.
Right, right.
You know, and there are people who got mad on Facebook and said it's because they slaughtered 25,000 whales a year in the dolphin massacre. But still, I mean, the Canadians slaughter hundreds of thousands of seals up there every year. So,
right.
So
right.
I said, you know, please, just this is the best opportunity, I said in the transmission, for you to show us who you are and to have full disclosure and actually... We cannot recover from this radiation. Japan will not recover. The radiation is already making the food radioactive. Everybody's in denial about the dangers of radioactivity.
Yeah.
Which is an area I worked in for over 15 years with several Nobel Prize winning scientists. And I'm very knowledgeable about nuclear sciences and radioactivity and different types of power plants.
Uh-huh.
So the next morning after... You know, we sent the transmission out electronically repeatedly, just asking for their help. I just got this female voice. I mean, this is audible. It's not, you know, something I psychically intuit. I can hear it. And I hear this woman this time, and she's just saying, I know, I know, you know, with this compassionate mother voice.
Ooh.
And it's just basically the Earth is to go through... This is just, it's not even the beginning because it's already been happening. We've had several tsunamis in the last, you know, decade, and it's getting worse and worse, you know, with all the different Earth changes. And the Earth is going to go through some very severe changes coming into the end of 2012.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is certainly, I've been studying the pole shift, and I've gone public with data on that. And there is a good documentary on PBS Nova called The Magnetic Storm, where they pretty much prove to you in the end that the pole shifting has already started.
Mm.
Now, NASA gets data on the pole shift from Canadian geologist Larry Newitt, who goes up and collects data on the actual position of the North Magnetic Pole.
Huh.
And this is really interesting because in the media all over the world was reporting that, oh, it's normal, the pole drifts, you know, so many kilometers or miles a year, and we just had to adjust the runways because we were lazy and we didn't do it, you know, on time. But that's not the truth. The truth is that in the year early 2000s, Larry suddenly noticed that the natural drift rate of magnetic north went from 10 kilometers a year, which is about 6.6 miles per year, to suddenly to 40-plus kilometers a year.
Mm.
And I wrote him a couple weeks ago because NASA's data was almost 8 years old from where he knew it, and I said, where is it at today? And it has consistently remained between 40 and 55 kilometers a year drift rate.
Uh-huh.
But ferromagnetic storm shows us that we're already in the middle of a magnetic pole shift, and there's a lot of opposite magnetism, giant bubbles of opposite magnetism forming on the north and south pole right now.
Oh, wow.
And that film was made in 2003, so that's an old film at this point.
Huh.
2007, I think it was made. I'm not sure exactly. So what happens next is that you start getting magnetic anomalies appearing on people's compasses closer and closer to the equator, and that's a sign that the actual magnetic pole shift is imminent. And that can still take hundreds of years or longer to actually have a complete shift. But here's the scary part. Here's what happens in a lab. If I broadcast through a radio transmitter the NASA sound of the sun, which is the true harmonic vibration of the sun recorded by NASA, and I hold a magnet at a distance from that transmitter, the magnet shakes, it vibrates.
Okay.
And then if I move the position of the transmitter, the magnetic field, the magnet will move towards it. And so the Earth's magnetic field has already shifted about 4 degrees in the last 10 years. And each degree is 167 miles of actual movement on the pole.
Wow.
So because the magnetic field is now so far ahead, what I'm saying is the physical Earth will move to catch up to it very, very suddenly.
Right.
And the earthquake in Japan, the data says that Japan physically moved 8 feet. So if we even moved 1 degree of pole shift physically, suddenly, 1 degree, that's 67 miles of physical movement.
Wow.
See how devastating that would be for tsunamis on the, you know, Pacific.
Oh, absolutely.
The Asian Pacific and the Ring of Fire zone. So,
oh, yeah. No question about it.
It'd be utterly devastating. And that's what concerns me that's coming up. And the reason it concerns me is, let me go back. I collect my data both scientifically but also through global consciousness phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And in my film, The Voice and Quantum Communication, those are two films where we really look at the power of the mind and global consciousness and what quantum physics and scientists and researchers at major American and European universities and Russian universities are doing in that field.
Mm-hmm.
It's utterly phenomenal if people really knew if they had actually seen these films. But anyway, I start getting all these emails when I do radio shows from people who have no contact with each other, and they're all dreaming about giant tsunamis hitting the west coast of the United States or California.
Wow.
And last, over a year ago, I had an incredible dream the Wednesday night going into Thursday before the Haiti earthquake struck in January, just, you know, over a year ago. And that same night, a guest in our house woke up, and she was staying in a little casita guest house on the property here. She had the same dream the same night. And in the dream, it's summertime, and there are people swimming in the water, you know, in Southern California. And I see this 100-foot wave coming, and I see a man and his son just disappear into the wave. And behind it, there's a 2,000-foot wave roaring towards California. And I fly above California, and it crashes over the coastal mountains, and it's heading towards Arizona.
Oh, my God.
That's the dream. Now, that night, my friend had the same dream, but she went higher up in the air, and she actually saw Florida, the East Coast, and all the way up the North Coast, that this thing was a massive global event.
Wow.
Now, months later, I'm on a radio show with Captain Jack in Texas, and he's announcing during the commercial break that he had this dream about a 2,000-foot wave crashing into California. And when he came back on the air, I said, Jack, when did you have the dream? He had it the same night that us two did.
Wow.
And then another, just recently, I met a young woman who had just had a baby boy, and she had the same dream that same night.
Wow.
Now, Native elders consider when two or more people have the same dream the same night, they take it very, very seriously.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But now I'm getting reports, all kinds of reports from, you know, a young man who met Jesus Christ who says that you better stockpile food and water for 2 or 3 months' supply, because if you wait till the end of May, it will be too late. And what does late mean? What's going to happen at the end of May? And then another, there's a story of a young little girl who lives in the Northeast, and an angel visits her and tells her the same thing. The end of May, you better have food. Now, these people don't have any contact with each other, so this isn't one of those migratory stories through the Internet. And then, you know, I get so many stories like that being sent to me, so I'm thinking, you know, I've never seen anyone predict a date for an event exactly. I was able to predict the Japan earthquake within minutes when I noticed on the NASA SOHO LASCO telescopes that as the sun rotates around every 27 days, I look at the magnetic spots. How powerful is the magnetism on the sun?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, all these people are looking at solar flares, and I'm looking at the flares, but more importantly, I'm looking at the magnetism, because I know Earth is a magnet. Uh-huh. Just recently, scientists measured the field strength of the core of the Earth at 25 Gauss, which is a weak magnet, but nevertheless, it's not as weak as the scientists previously thought. So when magnetism on the sun expels powerful magnetic streams of energy towards the Earth, when the magnetic energy in the sun is high, what's it going to do to another distant magnet? It's going to vibrate it. It's going to shake it.
Hmm.
And when the magnetism on the sun spots are low, then it's not going to have as much of a disturbing effect. There's still magnetism there, but it's different. It's not concentrated in these hot spots. So I posted it on Facebook, and within 15 minutes, Japan had its first 7.2. 3 days later, it had the 9.0.
Wow.
Now, even a year before the Chile earthquake, the big, you know, giant earthquake we had in Chile, in front of 700 people at a UFO convention, 3 days before my lecture, I told the owner of the conference, Bob Brown, I saw something very similar happening on the sun. I said, Bob, in 3 days, watch out. It's going to be huge. And he actually got up on the stage and told everybody and testified that David Sarita told Bob Brown that this was going to happen, and it did. So what I'm seeing now is, you know, it's everybody saying it has to do with the solar flares. No, it doesn't, because you can have medium-class flares and have very mild earthquake or weather activity. But it's not, the flares are not the only important part. They are a contributor. It's the magnetogram. It's how strong the magnetism is. And when Japan's 9.0 happened, there were four massive magnetic spots on the sun. Two of those had sunspots attached to them, and out of those two, we had a great number of M-class flares and 1X-class flares. So that's the full story there. So again, people are receiving this stuff in their dreams, but one of the most interesting dreams I'm getting involves flying saucers.
Oh.
And what it is that people are receiving messages. This comes from a little three-year-old girl. This is only 4 or 5 nights ago. She has a dream of this big angel coming towards her, and it tells her that all of the Earth angels are going to be collected and taken off the planet to another planet that's prepared for them already, because this one is going to get very hot. She saw the Earth getting very, very hot down here.
Whoa.
Now, that's pretty incredible. I mean, my new film, Hope for Humanity, deals with these new children and the quantum physics and the possibility of a rupture, an actual shifting of worlds where many people in this dimension are suddenly finding themselves in a higher dimensional Earth or possibly even, you know, what we call heaven. So how UFOs interplay with all this is that they've developed technologies that allow them to vibrate their ships into these other dimensions that are invisible to us.
Right.
Where space travel has a completely different set of physical laws. And the UFO, again, I saw in Berkeley in 1968, it doesn't accelerate and go taking off to New York City or going out into the moon. It just goes invisible right in front of you. You just see this metallic flying saucer with dozens and dozens of people looking at it that day, and it just, boom, it's gone.
Wow.
It goes in another dimension, and that's where they go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that makes sense. You know, it seems like that's just about the only way it could happen. And, thinking that you can only go as fast as the speed of light is just a limitation of your thought forms.
It's a limitation in the physical dimension with matter as we understand matter.
Right, right.
But when you have wave generators that can vibrate matter, the material of the ship and the pilots into another vibrational energy, they disappear from this dimension where they enter a new dimension where inertia and gravity, everything is completely different, and that's where they move about at incredible speeds. And that's why we don't see them flying by the moon and we get this great advance warning, oh, there's a spaceship coming like an ocean liner and it's going to park on Earth. They just pop in and they fly around for a while and they pop out.
Well, you know, some of the pictures that you had of the UFOs on Dan Aykroyd video, they're kind of like floating disks with a donut hole in the center, and they would be huge. I mean, if in relation to the planet, they would be huge. And I was thinking they look kind of like Dropa stones.
Mm-hmm.
They're fascinating, and there are so many of them.
Well, sometimes we can only, you know, those cameras on the space shuttle are able to see near and far ultraviolet light, which human beings don't see.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible the camera's only seeing the energy field, which, yeah, I mean, I've had experiences out of body where I've been taken aboard giant motherships that are many, many miles across.
Oh, wow.
In size. I've been meditating every day for 31 years now, and I've had experiences where I can see beings right in front of me with my eyes open with perfect clarity.
Wow.
A three-dimensional universe. But another person right next to me wouldn't necessarily see that.
Right,
Have that experience. And that's because their bodies and their atoms are vibrating at a much, much higher rate than ours.
Right, right.
Which you have to be in a certain state of vibrational energy field to see that and have that experience. And
well,
that's probably, you know, where all this is going is, you know, I spent my early years, you know, planting trees, over a million trees, working on environmental issues, and I worked for Nobel Prize-winning nuclear physicists. And, you know, we were in a group called Advanced Physics Corporation in Irvine, California in the late 80s and early 90s, trying to get funding for helium-3 non-radioactive nuclear energy, which is an advanced form of fusion. And it was amazing how much support we had from the Nobel community, but we couldn't get our funding to complete the final reactor. We had had funding in the previous decade before I was with this group. But I was sitting there with Glenn Seaborg, who chaired the Atomic Energy Commission under Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. You know, Murray Gell-Mann, Norman Rostocker, Bogan Magwitch, and Cliff, many, many incredible minds. And we had the ability to build a reactor where a meter squared could produce as much energy as these giant nuclear reactors with no radiation, with helium-3 fuel. And I learned everything about nuclear power plants. And I can tell you everything we're being told in the media is an absolute lie. There's just lying through their teeth to protect this nuclear industry.
Well, the nuclear and the oil and the coal and the biofuels,
yeah.
I mean, they're absolutely dragging their heels for the last 60, 70, 80, 90 years on releasing some of these advanced technologies that they've got patents for.
Yeah, we have anti-gravity and...
Yeah.
In black ops right now, some of the UFOs we're seeing are ours. We have zero point energy. This is really interesting because one of the scientists we worked with was John Goffman, who was one of the original Manhattan Project scientists who built the first atomic bomb with Seaborg, you know, Glenn Seaborg.
Oh, yeah.
Won the Nobel Prize with Macmillan for the discovery of the explosive type of plutonium. And Ed Goffman kind of became a rebel because he did studies on the human body and animals on low, what are known as low-level radiation. And so when you hear the word low-level radiation, you think, oh, it's safe because it's low. No. John Goffman did more advanced studies on low-dose radiation than any scientist in history. And I knew John before he died at Berkeley, and we talked quite a bit on the phone, and he was supplying me data about the different types of radiation, the different radionuclides, and the human health effects of low-level radiation. And there's no doubt the Department of Energy and the Atomic Energy Commission knows that these low-level dose radiations will cause cancer epidemics, just a few people getting the cancer. In fact, Greenpeace says with 50 scientists doing the study that there were truly 100,000 deaths after Chernobyl and 250,000 cases of cancer. Helen Caldicott, a nuclear activist, said recently on Russian television news that there were 1 million deaths associated with it, and 40% of the soils in Europe to this day are radioactive, and the food thereof is radioactive, and she will not eat European food because of its radioactivity. Now, when levels get to the low level, which is what John Goffman was studying, and I urge people to look up John Goffman on Google and look at his studies, because there's nobody ever, no medical doctor ever has done studies like John has.
Okay.
And there's no doubt you see increases in different types of cancer depending on the type of micro dust particles in the nuclear clouds and explosion clouds and even just the fallout, the general fallout that people are exposed to.
Well, now what about the body scanners that have been foisted on us at the airport?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Especially John found that X-rays are brutal for women, utterly brutal in contributing to breast cancer. And that his goal was to, for women for mammograms, to get them on super efficient, very low dose X-rays that can give them a similar quality image. But unfortunately, they're giving us radiation in small doses is safe for you because, like in Japan today, the news is, well, the spinach is radioactive and so is the milk. But don't worry, you can eat a bunch of spinach and it's the same as getting an MRI. Well, an MRI is not good for you. It's brutal for you. And now, here's where it gets really tricky.
Okay.
The scientists I know at Motorola for 30 years had figured this out. The Department of Energy and the Electric Power Research Institute, called EPRI, did studies on ionizing radiation from high-tension power lines and the possible link between Down syndrome and leukemia. And there were definitely higher levels of Down syndrome and leukemia with children that were exposed to high-tension power lines, but one child would get it and the other wouldn't. And because they didn't see a uniformity in people with radiation exposure getting the same sickness, they said you couldn't prove that it was caused by that radiation. But the scientists at Motorola said that's because different people have different trace minerals and therefore metals in their bloodstream, in their tissue. If you have a lot of lead and some mercury in your body and the radiation ionizes that mercury and produces mercury ions, you're going to get sick way more than the person who doesn't have lead and mercury in their system. So that's the reason why one kid gets the cancer and the other doesn't. Children are more affected by harmful radiation than adults because their DNA is growing so fast and their cells are dividing so fast because they're in mass growth rate, growth spurts, that once you mutate a couple of cells in an accelerated growth pattern, you get cancer because cancer is a mutated reproducing cell. So if one child is exposed to their water supply or their local environment, a lot of heavy metals, even the utensils and pots and pans that their parents are using, then that child will get ionization of those metals more than someone who doesn't. And that is the number one problem why it is not acknowledged and proven that even in the case of Chernobyl, conservative news says, a few thousand or even hundreds died in Chernobyl, depending on who you talk to. Because they say you can't prove that those cancer cases that spiked all over Europe and all over Russia were due to Chernobyl, because because there are people who live in the same neighborhood who didn't get the cancer. And the explanation I just gave you is the real reason.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the most deadly forms of radioactive transmission of particles are tritium. Tritium is radioactive hydrogen, and of course water is H2O, mm-hmm. which is, you know, hydrogen and oxygen. And tritium mixes with ordinary hydrogen in water and in human blood. It bonds to it and forms tritiized water, which is radioactive water. And tritium has a half-life of 12 and a half years. So every 12 and a half years, half of its radioactivity falls off. But in 12 years, tritium will do so much damage to a human body. It is a mutagen, meaning it mutates your DNA.
Well, where does it come from?
It's in nuclear reactors. It is literally, because they use water to cool the reactor, it breeds it, and then it also uses tritium. Some nuclear reactors actually inject tritium, and they manufacture tritium. And tritium is used in H-bombs. It's part of the thermal blanket inside of a hydrogen bomb. So breeder reactors, nuclear reactors, breed plutonium, and they breed tritium for the weapons programs. So that's where they get it from. It's not very abundant in very many natural sources on the planet. So when the Japan reactors exploded, all the hydrogen exploded, that hydrogen, a lot of it was tritiized. So tritium molecules in the air, in the water vapor, in the cloud layer are hard to detect. They're not as easy to detect as things like cesium and iodine.
Okay.
Iodine has a half-life of only 8.5 days, depending on its stability, not necessarily. So half of its radiation falls off every 8.5 days. So it, you know, it's definitely dangerous for at least 3 or 4 weeks, you know, traveling from Japan to here. Mm. But things like plutonium-238, Pu-238, is so deadly, utterly the most deadly stuff there is.
Mm.
Next to tritium is Pu-238. It has a shorter half-life than regular plutonium. Might have half-life, depending on the type, to tens of thousands to even billions of years.
Oh, my God.
Uranium is radioactive for billions of years. So micro dust particles of uranium floating, you know, towards the United States, if it lands on your soil, that soil is going to emit radiation into the water and into the vegetables forever.
It'll
never go away. And that is what has happened in the European soils after the Chernobyl incident. They're still radioactive to this day. The soils around Chernobyl are still radioactive to this day. The cesium falls off, you know, it's radioactive for a long time also, but it's nothing like the uranium and the plutonium family. One grain of plutonium-238 will kill you. One grain.
Wow.
So now here's the big why. The media says, don't worry, it's the same as when you travel on United Airlines and you're being exposed to cosmic rays in the airplane, because the higher up in altitude you are, the cosmic rays penetrate through the airplane. And then they say it's the same as talking on your cell phone. I'm sorry. You have alpha radiation, which is very short-wave radiation. Its radiative field is only a few inches from the particle. But if the particle itself, the micro piece of dust, is on your skin and it's emitting alpha, then it's transferring itself to your DNA.
Ooh.
You see, because you're looking at dust particles. You're not looking at cosmic rays that are shining from outer space and going through the belly of the airplane. You're looking at actual particles of dust. Then you have beta radiation, which is pure intense electron energy, and it has a longer wavelength. It radiates a little further than alpha. Then you have neutron radiation. Now, this is where everybody has been lied to about the plant itself.
Okay.
When a nuclear reaction, slow fission of uranium under a controlled, computer-controlled environment where you're maintaining a precise temperature with the coolant, it is emitting neutrons, and neutrons are neutral, and they bombard the container and the power plant itself. For 35 years, they should have already replaced the whole container. Because the container starts to become brittle, which means it can crack very easily. And that's exactly what has happened. Now, some very young PhD physicists at MIT wrote a blog saying, I don't believe those reactors will ever crack open, and here's why, because of 7 inches of steel and there's this much concrete. And I'm just sitting there like, you know, you need to have your head examined, whoever wrote this, because all my friends in Tokyo didn't leave Tokyo because they read that stupid article.
Right.
And they stayed there, and now they're all being exposed to radiation.
Wow.
Now, the problem is the neutrons make it so brittle that once you have even an earthquake and some what I would consider moderate overheating at this point, it's already cracked it wide open. And it wouldn't do it if it was brand new. It's doing it now because of the intense neutron radiation. The next level of radiation is X-rays, which go right through solid objects, and gamma rays, which go through virtually everything.
Really?
In fact, I was filming with a Canon XL1 video camera the nuclear power plant in outside of Phoenix in the dark. And when I looked at my videography later, you could see this big purple flash that just flashed through the nuclear power plant.
Wow.
And those are the gamma rays that you get, these gamma bursts during the fission of the uranium. And it just flashed like a flashbulb right through the cement and through the metal container.
Oh, jeez.
And the gamma radiation, of course, is the worst because it's the most powerful. And it's a mutagen as well. It mutates everything in its path. So our nuclear power plants, in fact, if you look at some of these gamma detectors out there, if you go to the East Coast, like right now on radiationnetwork.com, you'll see some of the areas where the nuclear power plants are. They, you know, they have higher radiation levels than places that are in the middle of nowhere.
Mm.
So because they are radiating all the time, and you cannot stop gamma rays. I'm sorry, that the container is not blocking it. The problem is most of our power plants are so old, incredibly old, most of them are brittle at this point. They're very easy to crack open.
Wow.
And many of them have had cracks and radiation leaks that go unreported by the media.
Right, right.
And that's because and now they're trying to say, well, radiation, a little bit of it isn't going to hurt you at all. But because they don't know how to stop those leaks, and hospitals are another major source of radioactive waste and radiation because they have X-ray machines and CAT scans now, which are worse than X-ray machines.
Yeah.
So there's a number of different places of this unnatural radiation. But the worst thing about a fallout is if this goes on for months in Japan, and sometimes the winds will blow towards, you know, the west coast of Canada, the United States, and Mexico, and sometimes it won't. But when you lose control of a core, you have to wait until those fuel rods have their energy cycle has expired for the radiation levels to drop.
Huh.
So it doesn't matter how much water you throw on there. All you're doing is you're making tritium, you're making all sorts of nuclear particles, and you're making hydrogen, which just explodes. And that's all they're doing.
Oh, geez.
Well, the core is exposed on at least one of them, and possibly two or more of them right now. When there's been photography taken. So let's go back to our UFOs again, because we've documented numerous cases of UFOs flying near nuclear power plants on the East Coast, nuclear missile silos.
Right.
We know they know that they're aware of this. We know that they can detect radiation. We know that they do have the ability to help us. And I really think that, you know, this is their opportunity to prove to themselves that they care about us and that they can actually demonstrate superior technology. The problem is every time these things come into our airspace, we freak out and start firing deeply, deeply classified weapons at them.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a whole program to disinformation to make them the bad guys, and I think that's part of the reason why there's so many negative spins on the alien movies that make them sound
right.
You know,
we're terrified.
Right, exactly. And, of course, if we're kept in terror anyway with terrorist alerts and this and everything, we're basically being herded down the chute to our slaughter, basically.
Yeah.
So
when I did one of my first transmissions to the Palladian ships, The answer I got back was the reason I asked them, why don't you come close like you did in 1968? And they said, because you have classified beam weapons,
right,
that you've been shooting us down with. We can't get close anymore. We want to help you, but your military is too afraid of us. That was a clear answer that they gave me. And when I sent that broadcast out was my birthday, August 21st, last summer. And August 22nd, a UFO was shot down in the Sierra Nevada mountains.
Wow.
And the next day, the mountain was on fire in the forest where it was shot down. And it was over the Internet, over YouTube, that everyone saw the UFO in near Bakersfield or Sacramento. I forget where. Somewhere in there. And the military had cordoned off the area in the forest, and they had retrieved another, you know, crashed flying saucer.
The
Bolivians told me that, literally, I sent my transmission out just before that happened. That's when they told me, we're trying to get close. You guys keep shooting us down.
They can't
help us. That's my point. We want help in Japan right now, but we're sitting on weapons that I know everything about. You know, the Tesla death ray. The Tesla death ray was developed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, according to J. Edgar Hoover FBI files, in 1943. Tesla died in 1943. He had a meeting with President Roosevelt the next day, which was the day that he had died, January the 7th, 1943. And Wright-Patterson Air Force Base was developing the weapon, which is exactly where the Roswell craft was taken. Now, Boyd Bushman, Steve Martin's senior scientist, tells me on camera that he is friends with a Navy doctor who was treating a young pilot from radiation burns who was given instructions to chase UFOs out of Texas that were in New Mexico, and he chased them to Roswell, and he personally shot them down.
Wow.
But the beam weapon was so hot, it burned the young pilot's skin. And he was telling the doctor all about what he'd just done, and he saw the aliens, landed his plane in the desert, and he saw the aliens, and then he was taken to the hospital.
Wow.
Now, that weapon at the time was the Tesla death ray, and you cannot even believe what that weapon is today. We are literally in Star Wars. Reagan announced Star Wars and the ET threat at the UN, it was only made to look like, this is how the military works, they develop something classified, they talk publicly about this Star Wars weapons program, and they publicly make it look like it's a failure. They don't want anybody to know the kind of weapons we have. We have weapons that make nuclear weapons obsolete right now.
And I've heard that there's technology so advanced that it's approximately 10,000 years ahead of anything that we have, you know, on the surface of the planet. You know, mountains that literally unzip and rezip, and, you know, light refracting things, and nano elevators that go to other planets. I mean, it's just anything we can imagine, most likely it probably is in development or has already been back engineered.
Yeah, that's what the former head of Lockheed Skunk Works. Virtually said, you know, to a group of people at UCLA at an alumni speech, he said that anything you can imagine, we already know how to do and more. We already have the technology to send ET back home, which means we have ET here.
Right.
So,
right. And probably more than one type, too.
Yeah.
I've heard there are 72 types, and some of them are pretty powerful with their telepathic communications.
And so it's very difficult, you know. The standard model is that we use regular radio transmitters and send messages at the speed of light, and we listen for ET signals, and we can't hear any.
Oh, criminy.
All of that is a cover-up.
Of course.
And people like Spielberg and Lucas are completely in the dark as to what we really have. And they're really the highest source in Hollywood for this kind of information that ends up in all these Hollywood movies.
So they're leaked information from the black operations, basically.
Yeah, they're connected to black ops. They will not let, you know, Spielberg started out on the light and the right path with Close Encounters of the Third Kind, my favorite movie ever made.
And then he turned to the dark side.
but much more mystical and positive extraterrestrial. And
he went
into the darkness, and now all the new movies are simply about fear, you know.
Oh,
he gives us a little bit, like he gave us in the new Indiana Jones movie, you know, with the crystals.
Well, yes.
And he does know something, but Dan Aykroyd knows way more than Spielberg. I mean, far
oh,
more.
Oh, really?
Man, far more. His mind is so much more advanced than Spielberg.
He is brilliant. I mean, you can't deny it. When you're listening to him on that video, my God, the man is an absolute genius.
Yeah, and we edited out the studio that... See, I made the movie independently with a partner, John Johnston, and we started out at Lionsgate Films, and we had one there take us to Arclight Films with the movie. And they thought people didn't have the attention span, so we had to cut out half of his interview.
Oh, my God.
And
oh,
I thought,
geez.
Well, they do have the attention span. They said, no, just keep cutting it down.
Oh, no.
So we cut out most of what Dan said, in fact, some of my favorite stuff. And then when we did the deal with the studio, like, I funded that movie with my wife's savings, you know.
Oh, geez. Good for you. It's
and when the studio did the deal with us, they gave us an advance against what were known as the royalties, and I was still, you know, $50,000 in debt on the movie.
Right.
And then the studio ripped us off, and they've never paid us a dime.
Oh, I hear that all the time with guests on the show, that their work has been stolen. And
Dan warned me. He said, David, you're never going to see any money. They're going to steal this, and you're
Oh, yeah.
They're ruthless people in Hollywood.
Yeah.
They're ruthless
yeah.
to the independent filmmaker.
Oh, yeah. It's too bad you can't rework that yourself and add what was lost to it, because it's just priceless.
Well, because I signed a 25-year term with this company, and they're in breach of contract, but to fight their lawyers, I don't have the money to fight them.
Well, now let's get back to what we were just talking about, because this is really important. So we're living in multiple realities, and the reality that we're talking about is one that a lot of people now are aware of. There's a growing awareness that there are black operations, that there is technology, that NASA is a cover-up, it's a cover for the Real Space Program, which is completely kept dark and secret, and that there is a shadow government that's running the world. So now, how do we start to break through the chains of command? How do we start to, you know, the corporations, they're pretty powerful. How do we begin to, we're kind of screwed here.
Well, you need senators and representatives that firstly have been given the evidence that this is all real.
But
and one of the
bought.
Things I've done is I know people at Boeing, Lockheed, and at NASA who are program managers who have all told me that it's all real.
Oh, yeah.
The problem is Congress is so asleep and laughing on the matter. And what you need is people like Stephen Bassett and his political movement to get disclosure. You need proper disclosure. And even on CNN this past year, major Air Force officials testified that UFOs have visited our nuclear bases, and they were witnesses to actual cases. They still don't get it. They still think, what? What are these guys saying? And they just ignore it. And then you need a president who actually understands that we don't even need to be burning fossil fuels anymore. We don't need to be fighting in Libya
because
we're afraid of the control of the price of oil out of.
Well, and there's the poppy fields and the drug cartels and the rest of that too. But
we don't need it because we're sitting on technology right now that came out of Roswell.
Exactly.
And the original Battle of 42, where we retrieved a couple of those saucers, according to George C. Marshall's memorandums, that we already have this technology.
That's 20 or 30 times clearance higher than the president.
Right. And even Glenn Seaborg, who was chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission under Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, he told me, this is a really wicked story.
Oh, just let's hear it.
We can talk about right in the intro. When I was working on the Helium-3 fusion project, Howard Hughes was just about to fund it way before I was part of this research on Helium-3.
Oh.
And what had happened is the fact that Hughes was interested in it really disturbed the Atomic Energy Commission, because they needed nuclear power plants to breed nuclear weapons fuel. And what they didn't want to have was non-radioactive nuclear power plants where you couldn't breed any weapons fuel, because you need the radiation, you need the neutrons to turn uranium plutonium.
Yeah.
And you need tritium for H-bombs. So,
yeah.
And tritium has a shorter half-life, so you need to keep replacing it in the H-bombs. And that was the mentality back then,
yeah,
when they were building bombs.
Ugh.
But even worse is that Howard Hughes was hired a man named John Meyer, who was running for president, you know, back in the 70s, to pay every presidential candidate $1 million if they will stop nuclear testing.
Mm.
And John Meyer told me personally, he lives in exile in a country where I'm not allowed to say,
right,
he said that Howard Hughes was fine. He was never hiding in his hotel in Vegas. That was an actor they had in here, the real Howard Hughes. I worked for him. He was fine. And he hired me to stop the bomb. And I realized that Seaborg was the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission who was in charge of the bomb. So I asked Seaborg personally when I drove him to the airport one day. I said, you know, I told him, I said, you know, tell me about Howard Hughes and how he was trying to stop nuclear weapons testing. And he started shaking. And he said, damn him. He almost stopped our nuclear weapons program. And I know what they did to him. They had an actor in there, which no one was allowed to see, because it wasn't Howard Hughes. The real Howard Hughes was taken away, and he was either given a deal or they murdered him.
Well, I can tell you what happened to Hughes. Aristotle and Onassis took care of him,
mm-hmm,
and they took over his empire.
Wow.
That was how Hughes got. Yes, they took everything from...
nobody messes with the nuclear weapons program. So it was, there were actually moratoriums politically against the development of non-radioactive nuclear energy in Russia and the United States. It was illegal because you couldn't have a power plant to breed your bombs fuel, so nobody was going to get any money. And when I introduced the Advanced Physics Corporation to some of the richest people in the world... Every time an investor was interested, they got a call from the Department of Energy, don't put any money in this company.
Yeah.
And then Glenn Seaborg became our chairman, and we thought he was like Darth Vader who turned to the light. He saw that we needed a non-radioactive nuclear power plant, and it took us forever to realize that he was sent there by the CIA to stop us from the inside.
Yeah.
He dismantled the company and fired the chief scientist who invented the non-radioactive nuclear energy, Dr. Bogdan Maglich.
Wow.
So we were completely taken by him, and then he died, and the whole company and the whole effort fell to pieces.
Well, that leaves us now in a very dangerous, precarious position, because we're heading for the sixth extinction now event, a 26,000-year cycle?
Yeah, we're looking at, because we've turned our backs on all the best environmental technologies.
Yes.
We've made it too expensive so only the rich can afford an electric car.
Thank you.
And so we're not going to save the planet. And there are powers, there are extraterrestrials watching over this planet. And when I sent the message out on the transmitter, the message got is, you did not comply to natural law. And they've given us enough time. Sorry, it's over.
Well, it's not like we're going
to be taken out.
It's not like
that's what's going on right now. We have weapons. We're fighting them. They want to stop us from ruining this planet. We're fighting over oil, and now we're fighting for more nuclear power plants. And because the radiation has permanent, long-lasting effects on ecology, they're just not going to take it.
No,
there are beings that want this planet saved. And you may see an Armageddon.
Yeah.
My prediction is in the next 50 years that actually involves extraterrestrial races trying to stop us from destroying this planet.
Well, I think it's going to be before 50 years.
Oh, I know. I'm being very conservative.
Yeah, I mean, that's nice of you to stretch it out, but I think, you know, we're at the hourglass has got a few drops of sand left in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're right at 11:59 and counting.
Yeah, so. No, it's already happening.
It really is, and as you mentioned, the sun, with its electromagnetism, is affecting the other planets, and that's coming from the central sun, which again comes from the core of the center of the universe. Yeah. So all of these things are aligning up, and we're moving at hundreds of thousands of miles an hour towards the other side of the galactic plane. So, you know, what's going to happen is anybody's guess, I would think.
Yeah, the type of fusion we were doing was helium-3 fusion, and helium-3 is absolutely environmentally pure. It's even more pure than the government's hydrogen and tritium radioactive hydrogen fusion program. But what's interesting about helium-3 is the largest inventory we can see is in moon dust.
Huh.
Moon dust. One shuttle bay in the space shuttle, one cargo bay full of moon dust, has enough helium-3 in it, according to Pacific Gas and Electric, the utility in the Bay Area, to meet the entire energy demands of the United States for a whole year.
Wow.
So trips to the moon would be very profitable, Clinton Ashworth wrote in the 1980s interview with me. And yet, what's amazing is what Richard Hoagland has uncovered in all these E.T. moon bases and all these mining operations people have seen in the backside of the moon.
Yeah.
The E.T.s have been mining helium-3 for thousands of years.
And didn't they tell us to get off and not come back, and that's why we haven't been there?
Because the moon dust is loaded with helium-3.
That's
9 grams of helium-3 completely outstrips, equals the energy equivalent of 1,000 barrels of oil. It's almost 10 times more energetic per fuel weight than uranium, and there's no neutrons, there's no gamma rays, no X-rays.
Something's got to give.
And our Nobel community was supporting this, and I was told, when I spoke in Congress in 1993, and in the House of Representatives, and I was told that we can't just go funding everything that everybody asks for here. And I said, how many people come in with 5 Nobel Prize winners asking for money? And are you saying that you don't even trust their opinion and decision on what is a good energy investment?
Wow.
And they turned us down. The government turned us down for funding, of course.
Wow.
Because it would be the end of the nuclear power plant race. And that was in 1993. That we spoke in Congress, and that was the end of our battle to try to get helium-3 funded.
Wow.
The physicist Bogdan Magwitch, we went on to landmine and bomb detection, and I was president of his company for a while, and then retired from that, and now I make films. So it's over. There is no interest in seriously in funding these non-radioactive nuclear energies.
Well, David, we're going to have to come back and have another chat because we could go on for hours.
Yeah, and we're out of time.
And we're out of time.
It's been great.
Boy, what a wonderful chat with you. I really, there are so many different directions we can go in if you would like to come back, and we'll pick up maybe where we left off.
Yeah, we can do that later.
Well, that'd be terrific. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, and just mention your websites again so people can check you out.
The websites are voiceentertainment.net, which is where my new films are. Lightstreamtechnologies.com is where my energy pendants that raise your auric energy field. Lightstreamtechnologies.com, and so that's where you can get a hold of me.
Terrific. Thanks
a lot,
David.
Thank you, Lance. It's been good.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye-bye, everybody.
Hi, this is producer and composer Nelson Ortega. If you're an independent artist looking for airplay, BBS Radio is the place for you. BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
You are tuned in to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.